talk, because there's different phases of awareness about biochar. So when we first started giving talks on this, it was sort of fun. You got to tell this whole neat little story about what happened to the Amazon and how it increased yields and all that. So the first part of the awareness of it is just what is biochar, and that's kind of the fun phase. Then after we did this for a while, the questions we started getting were basically, where could we get it? We created enough of a buzz with biochar that a lot of people were interested in using it, so really the issue was, where do you get it? Well, by now, there's plenty of people making it, and plenty of people have used it, and the question that I get is the one that Kathleen asked me at lunch, we're in Palm Desert, which is, what's the deal with biochar? In other words, where is this all going? So rather than make this sound like a Jerry Seinfeld talk, I gave you the title of What's the Future of Biochar? Because that really is the question. And when I do this, I'm telling you that I work for the people of California. I'm not here to advocate anything in particular. I'm just telling you a story. So to briefly summarize the whole backstory of biochar, there's places in the Amazon where the soil is obviously a lot more productive than other places. So you'll see things like this where there's a very clear rectangle of productivity, where it's a lot darker green than in other places. And the interesting thing about that is that's existed despite nobody having farmed that for over 600 years. If you think about what happened in the Americas, when Europeans came over, they brought a lot of diseases with them. So in a lot of cases, 90% of the native population died. And it caused this huge disruption in their society. In a lot of places in the jungle, we had farms and other things going on, but because so many people died off, they quit farming them. And in this case, this particular plot hadn't been farmed for 600 years. If you get to these places where you see the productivity, and they're well known in Brazil, they actually have parks that are dedicated to these soils, and they're known by the locals. If you compare them to a local soil, let's look at the one on the right. That's a typical tropical soil, very light colored. We say it's heavily oxidized. There's just a thin layer of topsoil right on the top. It can be very difficult to farm, actually. The one on the left is where they've used something like biochar. So it's actually known as terra preta in Brazil, where they speak Portuguese, which translates to dark earth. So it's dark all the way down 6 feet. It's remarkably dark. It's stands out all by itself, and there's been a number of different studies done on why this is and what all is going on. One thing we do know, there we go. One thing we do know is it's anthropogenic in origin. When you dig into this, you do archaeological studies, you find that there's a lot of pottery shards and evidence of former cooking fires and other things in there. And if you do radiocarbon dating, and a lot of these places, whatever they did hundreds of years ago. So it's something that man did a long time ago, and for whatever reason, it's persisted. So that's a nice little story about the Amazon. The question becomes, can you really do that here? Can you do it in places outside of the Amazon? Is that something we can recreate? Short answer is, yes, you can at times. This is from a turf field in near Escondido, which is San Diego County, California. So huge field of turf, goes hundreds of acres all the way from the road up to the mountains. We basically put a square of biochar down there and then flagged it and told the people to go ahead and plant their turf seed, plant the grass seed in there, let that grow, and then once the turf grows up, we figured we could undercut that, bring the sod back to campus and work with it. Well, I had my nice little white flags out there. Unfortunately, the first thing the farm crew did was yank up all the flags, an experience many of you have had, I'm sure. And then I wondered, where am I going to find this? Because this is this huge field of turf. Go see the farm manager. He says, hey, no problem. I know exactly where it is. It's because it's the greenest spot in the whole 100 acres of turf. It really made it this dramatically greener, which is a great story. Problem is, I can't do that every time. And so the real part of this talk is, why is it you can or cannot do that? So to do that, we got to think a little bit about how you make biochar. And basically, you're going to take a big pile of dead organic matter. Biomass. And that's going to be maybe half carbon. A lot of it's going to be water. We're not going to burn it. If we burned this, it would go all the way to ash. And the carbon would just go off in the atmosphere as carbon dioxide. So instead, what we're going to do is we're not going to let very much oxygen get into most of that pile. And it's going to go through a process we call pyrolysis, which essentially is going to heat this up quite a bit. And because it's heated, it's going to rearrange that carbon molecular structure. Take out some of the impurities and other things. And if you do it just right, you end up with something that's mostly carbon, and has biological activity, and for that reason we call it biochar. Oh, why am I going backwards? Okay, so reasons why does biochar not work? Well, the first reason, whatever you get from a supplier, he'll tell you it's biochar. The reality is we all know it's not all biochar. And it's not being dishonest, it's just a matter of how it's produced. First thing, a lot of that's going to be ash. So even though they've tried to keep the oxygen out of it, there's no way of keeping, probably no way of keeping it all out of it unless you go through very stringent conditions. So you're going to end up with a lot of ash, which is both good and bad. It's not necessarily a bad thing, which is something you need to be aware of. It's not all biochar. Second thing, there's probably a lot of water in there. And that also is not necessarily a bad thing. If you put pure biochar down, try to apply it, you're going to get a huge dust cloud of black carbon floating all over the place. It becomes almost a toxic situation. And I know this because the first time we did it, that's basically what we had. The people that applied it had to put on respirator masks to do it. So what's out there is not all biochar, first of all. And second of all, it's not all carbon is biochar anyway. It can be in different forms. Sometimes when they're in the process of making biochar, they end up creating compounds that are more related to oils and petroleum distillates and whatnot. So it's not all strictly biochar. So let's talk about what people usually say is biochar. Usually when they give talks like this, they talk to you about sheets and sheets of carbon. So if you remember from your organic chemistry, carbon bonds together, it forms these six-member rings. If you get a bunch of these six-member rings, you basically end up with sheets. So it's more two-dimensional than anything else. If you have something like graphite, it's basically just stacks and stacks of these sheets. And within the sheet, it forms a very tough two-dimensional bond. Two-dimensionally, within the sheet, all those bonds of carbon, they're very tough. They're heterocyclic, or not heterocyclic, they're aromatic rings, they're very tough, hard to break. But between the sheets, that's a different situation. That's held together by weaker forces, van der Waals forces. So a lot of chemistry and other reactions can happen between those sheets of carbon. And some of this is good for us because it means our fertilizer ions can sit between those sheets of carbon. And biochar is known to have exchange sites. So these exchange sites mean that they can hold and release nutrients. Good news is that it's known to have both cation and anion exchange sites. And if you think about fertilizer ions, they can be both cations or anions. So that's a great thing. However, if you think that through a little further, it means that the biochar is necessarily not pure sheets of carbon, because then you wouldn't have both anion and cation exchange. You just wouldn't have those charges on there. So there's other things going on here. There's impurities that can happen. Sometimes it's delivered. Sometimes that's a good thing. It's what you want to have happen. So second reason why biochar doesn't always work quite like you think it is graphite sheets. It's actually shreds of graphite, but it's not really pure graphite. The molecules may have things in between them. So a lesson from this is when we try to categorize biochar, and we actually have certification for biochar in my state now, you can't really just categorize it by simple analytical chemistry. A lot of the schemes for certifying it are based on carbon content. That really doesn't tell you that much about what you're getting. So another thing about biochar is it has a three-dimensional structure. If you hold a piece of charcoal up to the light, you'll see it has a honeycomb-like structure like this. You see all these little holes in it? So you're essentially creating little pores there that'll hold water, which is a great thing because we know that nutrients, a plant can't take up a nutrient unless it's dissolved in water, right? So you've got these pores that are going to hold those nutrients in with the water, and then they can be attached to those exchange sites so they don't just wash out. And so because you have this structure, not only do you have the pore structure that hold things, but you've also expanded beyond just a simple sheet. So now you can have a lot more surface area and a lot more exchange sites. And so in theory, if you add biochar to the soil, you're going to end up holding a lot more nutrients and water. The nutrient part, a lot of biochars, I can tell you, do a good job of holding and releasing nutrients. That part's good. The water part's a lot sketchier. If you do the calculation, even if the biochar was just pure, perfect capillary tubes, you'd have to add an incredible amount of biochar to get the water savings that a lot of people claim you get with it. So that part of it's a whole nother thing. So what is biochar? Well, it's not just molecules. It also has this physical structure. We can alter that structure for specific purposes, and then that leads to these different types of chars that I'm going to talk to you about. A third thing, if we're talking about the future of biochar, our definitions for this need to get away from just simple physical chemistry. You need to do things like measure absorption. And there's whole big debates out there about this. I have a good friend, Hugh McLaughlin, come and spend, you know, probably this whole symposium. Well, actually spend days telling you about why you should do it the way he thinks you ought to do it or whatever. But there's good reason for that. It's because what we're really interested in isn't how much carbon it has. It's more the absorption and some of the other properties it has. So we're going to get into the different types of biochar that may be out there. And these are sort of arbitrary. Most of them are arbitrary anyway on my perspective about why we want to talk about biochar this way. So one's more just a general char, and probably most of what you're using out there in agriculture is this sort of general char thing. So it's basically you're going to create this by making a kiln or something like that that's going to keep most of the oxygen out, and you're going to heat this at a pretty good temperature. It's not a real precise way of making it. So they'll tell you it's pyrolyzed at 450 degrees C, but what does that mean? Does that mean that you just instantly got up to 450 degrees centigrade and held it there for 3 hours and then instantly cooled it back down to ambient? That almost never happens. It may mean that it went up, took you a day to get up to 450 and you held it there for 3 hours and then let it cool down. It may mean that you spent all day getting to 450 and then you just cut off the heat and let it slowly cool. It's very imprecise that way. The application of this is usually in the tons per acre range. So, one thing you can think of with this is it is a very good way of recycling waste because you're using a lot of it. The other thing is, if it is high in carbon, it's a great way of sequestering carbon because, again, you're using a lot of it. So that's all very good. It's probably going to have ash in it. It's almost certainly going to have ash in it. So that can be both a positive or a negative. Many parts of the agricultural world, you have acidic soils, particularly in the eastern part of the U.S., where I grew up. We had to always lime the soil. So biochar has a liming capacity to it. That's great for them. Not so much for me in California, where we tend to have basic soils. It can be a problem, but it's certainly something we've got to account for. Another thing is, because you made this in kind of an imprecise way, that probably explains some of why it sometimes works and sometimes not, because it's not exactly what you thought it was. It's pretty likely that it does hold nutrients. That's something we've seen in the chars we've tested, and we have super sacks of different chars sitting around where I am to test. Generally speaking, the nutrient holding part of this holds up. Water savings, not so much. And that's the subject of a whole nother talk. In fact, it's probably a whole nother several talks. So other couple types of biochar to talk about would be ones that are more high tech. So if you look in the literature, there's a whole series of papers where people have engineered carbon and biochar and other things so they very specifically can hold and absorb ions. These are often used in reclaiming Superfund sites and other things like that, and they become known as boutique biochar. So sometimes you have a biochar that's specifically formulated so that it's going to extract cadmium from the soil, and thus you'll be able to reclaim a site that has too much cadmium. Or it may be a formal missile test range, and you've got whatever those compounds that are left over from the powder that they use to propel those missiles. Another one, and there's only a few places where they're making this, is what I would call a high-tech agricultural char. It really is made specifically for the purpose of improving agricultural soils. It's made from more of a material science approach, meaning instead of just trying to have some mass conversion of something into something else, they're very precisely doing that conversion. So it's active at much smaller rates, maybe only 100 or 200 pounds to the acre. So you're able to get this to be active at the same rates as fertilizer, which is great. You're much more able to apply that in an ag situation. It's generally a lot more expensive on a per pounds basis, on a pounds, tonnage basis, but using it at such a smaller rate that it becomes economical. Generally, these chars are only applied in the seed line. You're trying to do it in a very precise way, and it's really all about the interaction of the char with the roots. Okay, and then finally, getting away from the very specific chars, there's also high-volume uses of char, one of which we found we had in our low desert. We had a company that was willing to give us some char that was left over from some of their other processes, so we could literally apply this at 100 tons per acre. And when you start getting up above 10 tons per acre, you start to see a lot of soil physical effects. So where we had soils that are very heavy clay soils in the desert that are salt affected, we could actually apply the char, use that to drain out the salts and reclaim those soils. So that was a very good effect. Another thing is, this is a carbon source, so you can use it in things like asphalt. It has a nice open pore structure, and there's a lot of people that are taking biochar that may have been used for another purpose, recycling it and putting it into asphalt now. Water purification, there's a bunch of people talking about using it in that purpose, and there are chars that are made specifically for that. Feeding it to cattle is actually a big thing in Europe now. We have a problem doing it here because of our different rules and regulations, but you can feed it to cattle. It passes right through their system. They have no problem eating it when it's mixed into their feed. You cut down on the greenhouse gases. And the other nice thing about it is you age the char. It absorbs the nutrients from that pass through the cow's gut. So you don't get as much greenhouse gases evolved, and you get more of those nutrients going into the soil. It's great for improving composting also. One little caveat about all of this, there is a distinction between activated carbon and biochar you need to be aware of. Activated carbon basically is something we use because it's going to absorb something and not let it go. Biochar technically is something that has an exchange phenomenon. So it's going to absorb something and then release it at an equilibrium rate that's set with its environment. So it's not going to just grab it and not let it go. It gives us that exchange, which in agriculture we need, because otherwise it would absorb all our nutrients and you wouldn't get them back in the soil. So future biochar, just to sum all this up, first thing is you're going to need some sort of a certification. Like I said, in some states, California, we already have about 20 chars that are certified. OMRI certifies some biochars. But it needs to go away from just saying it's this amount of carbon. It needs to go back to the functionality so we can relate to what it does in the soil. A huge thing that would change is if you actually got carbon trading credit money for biochar. If that happens, suddenly we're going to be able to see a lot more biochar production and usage. There's going to be more material science approaches to this where it's more precisely made. And finally, really, if you think about it, biochar has always been around here. If you talk about soils, there's a big thing with soil carbon now. Some of the soil carbon can be divided, I always divide it into two classes, labile and recalcitrant. So labile stuff is what would just burn off after a year or two. Recalcitrant may have been in there for hundreds of years. If you think about it, how did you get recalcitrant carbon in the soil? In a lot of cases, we know it came from burning. Grasslands in the Midwest or the forests out in California, they burned, they left carbon behind. They actually made biochar, and that became your recalcitrant carbon. So that's pretty much what I had to say about biochar, and I think I've actually run right to the edge of my time, but I think I could take... No, ran over. Okay, so I broke my own rule. Sorry, guys.